You're listening to 88.1 FM, KPPPLP, Fargo-Moorhead, adding local color to your airwaves.
So this episode is going to include a conversation between me, Gustavo, my cousin, mi primo hermano, and Leroy, and we are part of a horizontal organization called the Boricua Diaspora Caucus, and we want affiliation with the DSA, but it's not branded by the DSA. We want the Boricua Diaspora Caucus to stand on its own. The DSA Boricua Diaspora Caucus. And we have a Twitter handle. It's at DSA Bori Sosh, DSA BORISOC. In the show notes, I will include a link to a document that lays down what we are about. We are for independence of Puerto Rico. We try to produce content that is bilingue. We do not have membership dues right now, but it's only currently for people who are Puerto Rican, half Puerto Rican. It doesn't matter. As long as you have a Puerto Rican parent, you have Puerto Rican heritage, we encourage you to be a part of this organization. We are working on doing direct action. We're direct aid. We are working on networking with people on the island. We are working on networking with charities and nonprofits already doing the work back home in Puerto Rico. It's a lot of work, and I would say there's like five really active members, and then there's maybe like 10 or 11 people who are very so there's like 5 to 6 really, really, really active people, and then there's like 8, 9 pretty semi-active people, like people who are interested, but there isn't enough groundwork laid out so they can contribute. Correct. So let's go ahead and get this podcast started. Welcome to the Knowledge Sacks Podcast, a podcast built on listener submissions, current events, and politics sprinkled with insightful historical context for curious leftist comrades. We're learning and we want to learn with you. We're planting seeds because we believe we only reap what we sow, so let's sow knowledge, positivity, and accountability and watch our garden grow together. To submit your local stories, provide historical context, elaborate on a subject, or make corrections to a previously reported story, shoot us an email at knowledgesacks01@gmail.com. You can find our weekly podcast on SoundCloud, Facebook, Twitter, Podbean, Libsyn, and YouTube. All relevant links can be found in wherever the description box may be located on whatever platform this podcast has been found. Also, I want to go ahead and apologize. I'm really sorry. I've been very busy. I have a personal life. I've worked 50 hours plus a week. My cousin's about to move back to Puerto Rico in February. Gustavo, my cousin that's staying here with me right now in Kentucky. And there's just a lot of things in my life that are going on right now, and that's that. So, I'm trying my best. I know I was supposed to release multiple episodes last week. That did not work out with my schedule. I'm so discombobulated and disorganized, and that's my fault, but it is what it is. So let's get started. I wanted to do some updates. You know, I've been talking a lot about Whitefish Energy Holdings because I'm not over it. And so there's like an inside ongoing joke in the Borisosh chat on Twitter and the DMs that I'm like Jimmy Dore because I never let stuff go. Look, it's just me. I don't let stuff go. That's it. It's a part of being Paula. It's a part of being Pauli. It's a part of being Paulita. It's a part of being who I am. I just don't. If you're going to do my people dirty, if you're going to do the Puerto Rican people dirty, I'm going to be talking about you. I'm going to be talking all about you and telling all everybody's friends about you because I'm full of chismes. And that's what I see the politicians and the news as. And another thing, too, in a sense, I guess I am like Jimmy Dore because I don't say things 100% correctly all of the time. And I'm sorry that the nomenclature and the correct terminology, I'm not perfect. I will get stuff wrong. My apologies. I'm making this podcast just to disseminate information out into the universe, and I appreciate critiques. I'm not saying that I don't not listen to them. I'm trying my best is all I can say. Anyway, so this article is from OpenSecrets.org. Whitefish spent $150,000 lobbying Congress after Puerto Rico disaster. It was published January 24th. The small Montana energy company that botched the critical rebuilding of Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria spent $150,000 lobbying Congress last quarter amid investigations, a disclosure report filed Friday shows. The fourth quarter lobbying report shows that Whitefish paid the firm Foley and Lardner to have five representatives lobby the Senate and House on the company's behalf. What the firm was specifically hired to accomplish is unclear. In the report, under specific lobbying issues, Foley and Lardner wrote Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority to rebuild transmission lines damaged from recent hurricane damage. The five lobbyists working for Whitefish included two former members of Congress, because that's that revolving door, guys. The government in the United States is absolutely corrupt and nobody is paying attention because everyone is literally just trying to survive. Everybody has to do all of these. There are people who have to do what they have to do to survive. All right? Sucking. Like, people are doing what they have to do to survive. People go to work. They are sucking metaphysical there too. I mean, everybody's doing what they have to do to survive. Everybody's just. Do you really think people are living the lives that they want to live? Do you really think people are free under this society that we live under? People are struggling. And it's because the lobbyists are ex-politicians who are screwing and committing ethnic cleansing on the island of Puerto Rico, specifically pointing this back to my people, specifically highlighting that point. That there is ethnic cleansing going on the island because of capitalism, because money, because capitalism is going to capitalism. Whitefish Energy and Foley and Lardner did not immediately respond to questions from the Center of Responsive Politics on Wednesday. Of course not. And let's be honest. With control, there will always be manipulation, and with manipulation, there will always be a power struggle. And with power struggle, there will always be this hierarchical form of what should and should not be. When we could literally live in a utopia, there's enough food on this planet to feed everybody. There is enough water to give to everyone. But since corporations are buying up aquifers in Latin America, cough, cough, that will be an episode upcoming. There's so much stuff happening in el mundo, in the whole world, that I just can't keep up with it. It's just so much happening. And then with my personal life happening, and at the same time this stuff happening, it's a constant bombardment of information and stimulus. And people are tired. I'm one of those people. I'm trying the best I can, and I just feel like I'm yelling into the void. People just don't care. People don't listen. Last year, Whitefish was thrust into controversy after it was awarded a $300 million contract, which we already know, which I've already established in previous episodes. The September disaster knocked out the power of 3.4 million residents and resulted in a death toll that may be upwards of 1,000. Remember that episode? I think it's the first episode. I talked about the actual death toll being between 985 to 1,065 people. The Puerto Rican government gave the two-person Montana Utility Company the contract almost out of the blue, without a competitive bidding process and with significant price markups. And now they're trying to privatize PREPA. And now they're trying to privatize... Oh, and in Puerto Rico, they just announced that they're going to try and privatize schools. And then there was a informe, a report that came out about the Puerto Rican school system and how broken it is and how they're passing students that when they take their college board exams, they fail them because they've been good students, but they didn't learn the actual material. Like they were, they got graded on their obedience and how obedient they were, not how they're retaining the information. I'll include a video link about that down below because I've already gone off topic. But anyway, so the article continues from Open Secrets. The deal also drew skepticism because the company is based in the small hometown of Ryan Zinke, Interior Secretary for the Trump administration. Zinke denied claims that he was tied to the contract. Quote, I had absolutely nothing to do with Whitefish Energy receiving a contract in Puerto Rico, Zinke said in a statement. Any attempts by the dishonest media or political operatives to tie me to awarding or influencing any contract involving Whitefish are completely baseless. Only in elitist Washington, D.C. would being from a small town be considered a crime, unquote. Basically, Whitefish Energy spent $150,000 lobbying the Senate and the House on the company's behalf. They paid Foley and Lardner. Another update. So this is from E&E News. So Puerto Rico's three-way duel to control the power company. As Puerto Rico claws back from its epic blackout. Oh, and by the way, last night, the north part of the island completely lost power because there was an explosion. So, I mean, nothing in Puerto Rico is normal. People back home will say, oh, things are normalizing. But nothing is what normal was before Hurricane Maria, for one. For two, they are kicking people out. And I'm going to talk about that later on in the podcast. But they're kicking people out of their homeland. And then the people who came to the mainland and staying in hotels provided by funding from FEMA, the deadlines to leave these hotels are up and coming. I mean, I'll make the connections in the podcast. As Puerto Rico claws back from its epic blackout, a battle is sharpening among the three government entities that want to break up the enfeebled power company and dictate its future. Yesterday was the four-month anniversary of Hurricane Maria, which smashed much of the electric grid. Infighting only promises to prolong the misery. According to new figures released yesterday by the Department of Energy, 406,600 businesses and residences, just under a third of all customers, are still without electricity. The company providing that energy, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, is so broke that it had to temporarily shut down two power plants this week because it couldn't afford the fuel. The question of who will oversee its undoing became the source of new disagreements this week. Will it be Ricardo Rosselló, the island's governor, who on Monday announced a strategy to sell off much of PREPA? Will it be the Federal Financial Oversight Management Board, La Junta Fiscal, which is posed to judge the utility's fiscal plan? Or will it be the Puerto Rico Energy Commission, which has clear legal authority but is in danger of being voted out of existence? This is what colonialism looks like. The people on the island have no autonomy. Their rights are being violated. Their human rights, their access to just basic, essential, modern-day amenities are complete... We don't have portable water for most of the people on the island. I covered that in episode 2. The water quality in Puerto Rico hasn't been abiding by the Safe Drinking Act for a long time, for decades. And then last episode, I talked about how the sewage company was privatized temporarily in 2000 and how great that worked out. It didn't. Newsflash. We have capitalized basic necessities in this country. All right? So you can read this article on your own. I really don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just wanted to illustrate, like, there's so much going on the island. Because, see, I'm going way off topic. I tend to do that. I apologize. But if you want to read more about that, go ahead. I really got to get started on the displacement and the ethnic cleansing that's taking place currently on the island. Just kidding. We're just going to go into this article because I really want to update people on this. So, this is from ABC News. Blackout hits northern Puerto Rico following fire explosion.
Breaking news out of Puerto Rico tonight, where there has been a major setback in efforts to restore power 5 months after Hurricane Maria. An explosion set off a big fire at a main power substation tonight. It caused a major blackout in several municipalities in the northern part of the island, including San Juan. These images show the damage. This happened as more than 400,000 power customers remain in the dark because of the hurricane.
So that was a clip from ABC News. An explosion and a fire at an electric substation threw much of northern Puerto Rico into darkness late Sunday in a setback for the U.S. territory's efforts to fully restore power more than 5 months after Hurricane Maria started the longest blackout in U.S. history. The island's Electric Power Authority said several municipalities were without power, including parts of the capital, San Juan, but they were optimistic it could be restored within a day as they worked to repair a substation that controls voltage. The blast illustrated the challenges of restoring a power grid that has already been crumbling before it was devastated by a Category 4 hurricane, which I talked about last episode. All right, so PREPA is roughly worth $4 billion, carries a $9 billion debt, which I talked about last episode. I mean, this is just going to be continual. This is going to be repetitive. None of the conditions in Puerto Rico have changed. All right. So with that being said, and how do people know about the explosion that happened at a substation in Puerto Rico? No. Because it's not breaking news. Like, people on the mainland do not care about Boricuas. We're not on anybody's mind. Trust and believe me. Many Puerto Ricans adrift in U.S. hotels after Hurricane Maria. After they lost their home in Puerto Rico to flooding during Hurricane Maria, Inge Melendez flew with her family to the U.S. mainland with three suitcases, and the hope it wouldn't take long to rebuild their lives. It hasn't worked out that way. For more than 4 months, more than four months later, the family of five is squeezed into two rooms in a hotel in Brooklyn. While her husband looks for work, they are stuck in limbo, eating off paper plates and stepping over clothes in cramped quarters as they try to get settled in an unfamiliar city. After the hurricane hit, we told the kids that every day was going to be an adventure. But not like this, said the 43-year-old Melendez. This is turning out to be really hard. Around the U.S., many Puerto Ricans are similarly adrift in hotels because of the September 20th hurricane. The move north spared them from the misery of the storm's aftermath on the island, but the transition has often proved to be difficult, disruptive, and expensive as people tried to find housing, jobs, schools, and even furniture and clothes to start fresh on the mainland. Melendez and her family shuffled between staying with relatives to a homeless shelter to a small hotel in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, forcing her to change schools for her three daughters in the middle of the semester.
Es difícil dejar tu isla. Es difícil dejar tus raíces, tus costumbres.
So she's saying that it's really hard to leave your island. This is a I should probably introduce the clip. So this clip is from the Associated Press, and it's an interview with this family who is living on the mainland. And I'm gonna play the clip.
Es difícil dejar tu isla. Es difícil dejar tu raíces, tu costumbre.
She's saying it's difficult to leave your island, it's difficult to leave your roots, your customs.
It is
in a place that you don't know anybody. This is what they do. This is what the United Corporations of America Kaka does. They isolate you from your roots, they isolate you from their culture, they enforce and they impose ideas that are not yours. They forced you, it's forced assimilation, and they want you to become the working class. They want the people wear the working class like it's a badge of honor, as it should be. But the way that we're treated in this country as working class people, we are treated like garbage. When I'm a cashier at a gas station, people literally throw their change at me. People treat me like I'm a part of the machinery, as I'm a part of the humming environment all around me in this store, full of colorful, brightly packaged food from the same five companies. We have the illusion of choice in this country. We have the illusion of freedom. We don't live in a free society at all. We live in a society in fear. If you're queer, if you're gay, if you're a non-cis heteronormative person, these values are imposed upon you, and you have to live in this particular way, with religion being thrown and squashed into your throat. And people do not live in a free society when you're a non-cis heteronormative person and you're constantly fearing that you're going to be raped or killed. We've already had 3 transgender people die this year. We've had 3 transgendered... We have had 3 transgender people die this year alone. It's February, guys. It's February. The year hasn't even started yet. And that's in an article that I've read recently. I don't even know, like, what are the exact numbers? Is that all that's just being reported in the news that we can see? Anyway, let me play this clip.
Far from the place they left a month ago in both distance and culture. But for husband and wife Angie Melendez and Fernando Moyet, this small hotel room in Brooklyn is their family's best shot at a future after their home near Puerto Rico's capital was destroyed by Hurricane Maria.
Ooh, did you hear that neoliberal speak right there? Oh, they can have a better life here in America, Kaka, working for slave wages. Because guess what, guys? Puerto Ricans, the displaced Puerto Ricans, we are going to be the new workforce for America, Kaka. We are the new brown people. Oh, isn't it great? I love this place. They treat us so well. We have air conditioning and we have GMO food products from the same 5 same 5 companies, all made in China. This makes a lot of sense. Thanks, globalization.
After the hurricane hit, they were forced to sleep for almost a month in their garage. They were given a flight to the mainland by a local charity. They had just 1 day's notice and 3 suitcases to pack.
Tres maletas con sueño. Tres maletas de desesperación.
So she's saying 3 suitcases full of dreams, 3 suitcases of desperation, 3 suitcases that said, help me.
Tres maletas de ayuda, de ayúdame.
Across New York and around the U.S., many Puerto Ricans are finding themselves adrift because of the September 20th hurricane. Maria destroyed more than 70,000 homes and damaged another 300,000. Many areas are still without power, and many businesses have closed. The result has been a mass exodus to the mainland. According to FEMA, there are nearly 4,000 families receiving hotel assistance from the agency across 42 states because their homes are too damaged to occupy.
I'm like, I adopted 63 families.
Many families are relying on volunteers like Sonia Velasquez to navigate the complicated network of benefits. FEMA has set a March 20th deadline for the program to end, and many families say they can't afford temporary housing without assistance. Velasquez says many families don't know where they'll end up next.
It frustrates me that they are misinformed, right? It frustrates me that there is not a plan, a long-term plan for them.
Eso fue una experiencia horrible.
Across town in Queens, Miguel Rosado has a binder full of pictures documenting the devastation in his hometown of San Juan. He's searching for a permanent home on the mainland for himself, his 10-year-old daughter, and 19-year-old adopted son.
There's stress. It's very stressful, really. I feel it's a brutal amount of stress because it's not a stable place.
Me siento con un estrés brutal porque no es un lugar seguro. Sé que en cualquier momento me va a decir lo mismo, vete.
According to a study by the
I know at any moment they can tell me to leave.
Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College, more than 200,000 Puerto Ricans could move to the U.S. mainland over the next 12 months. The greatest number are expected to...
All right, by the way, this report, like, this is how little they do their research, because there's articles coming from Florida that have said that there are already 200,000 Puerto Ricans viviendo in Florida and Central Florida and Orlando. Like, there are already 200,000 Puerto Ricans that have left and they're living in Florida and displaced from their communities. You hear it in her voice. You hear it in Señora Melendez's voice that she's saying that she's this is what they're doing to us. We are forced to move here. This is like the golden streets that we have always been told about. Just because there's a little like air conditioning. And that's something we talk about in this episode too, in the conversational parts of it. You'll hear my cousin and Leroy and I discuss this topic. So I'll go ahead and let the clip end here.
Settle in Florida. Leslie Rivera from the central town of Caguas has been shuffling among hotels in Tampa since December with her three kids.
I don't have clothes, I don't have anything for my children, and it's been very difficult, really.
She was approved for subsidized housing and expects to be settled soon, but tasked with finding a job and raising three kids in an unfamiliar place, the challenges won't end there. Robert Bumstead.
So she was saying, if it was me by myself, I would be able to fight. But, if I were alone, I'd have a fighting chance, but I have these three that I have to set an example for. That's what she said. Sorry, I got a little emotional, but it's just, it's a lot. You're hearing these people who are your people, like, they're suffering, and there's literally just people who are like, oh, you know, the U.S. government will handle it, someone else will handle it, she's gonna get subsidized housing, and then you'll have Republicans, you'll have conservatives tell you to your face that we're just living off the, we're mooches, that we're just leeching off the government. And it's like, don't you know that your extractive, your exploitative capitalism in our country, and most of, like, so many people, regardless of how ignorant they are, regardless of how machista they are, regardless of how patriarchal in their thinking they are macheteros, they are independistas, and they want freedom for the island. It's just so much information and sociological study here, and so much information. This is sociology in vivo. This is happening live right now, and it's so painful to see. Like, I've had to decolonize so much of myself, and every piece that is removed, whether it's extracted from me or from my island and from my people, it's another, it's like a fire of passion inside of me that just doesn't die, and it just gets bigger and bigger because it's consumed with so much anger. Look at how they're treating my people. And you're telling us that we should be grateful because at least that we get to live in this country. This country is actively killing people all over the world, including back home in Puerto Rico. Why should I be grateful? FEMA is an insurance company. They don't care. They're profitizing off of us. So you're hearing, the article continues. You can read it on your own. It just elaborates, the article elaborates on the injustice, the instability, I mean, these people have gone through trauma. They went through a hurricane that devastated their homes to the point where they're homeless in a country where with a language they don't even speak. They don't even speak English. Many of the people coming to the mainland no hablan inglés. All right. So here's another article. I'm reading you these articles because I need you to understand. I'm reading you these articles. I'm playing these clips because I'm going to connect it for you at the end. Well, I've already done it. So FEMA is an insurance company that's just trying to profit, because we all know health insurance companies are doing that right now, right? These people profit off of people's misery. That's what capitalism runs off of, the misery of the workers. And how are we going to make these people miserable and uncomfortable where they have to escape using drugs, using alcohol, using the substances that we sell, or we have a black market that provides these substances that isn't controlled or regulated? How are we going to kill off these people? Well, you know, we can just let them numb their pain with alcohol and drugs. And you know, there are so many people, and it's not as conspiratorial as you think, that the U.S. government is injecting drugs into these communities, right? How is it that we have a huge, massive opioid crisis in Puerto Rico, but the only people who are allowed to bring goods to the island are American manned ships? Like, nobody ever talks about that. You really think that people are coming in little rowboats from the Dominican Republic with drugs? You think they're going to make a trip that far? Like, just use your brain. The Jones Act imposed upon us adds extra tariffs. Like, we're being murdered by the U.S. government. We are being forced off of the island. We're being... There's white supremacy in our media, in our culture, and it's disgusting, it's despicable, it's sick. Anyway, this article is from the New York Times. Time is running out for Puerto Ricans sheltering in hotels. So I just talked about the family, right, Melendez, as an example of what's happening. These people are displaced, these people are feel disheartened, right? I mean... And the way they see it is, at least I'm not on the island without power. We just, like I've read earlier, there was a substation that exploded in San Juan because these substations are so old. And they think privatizing is going to fix it, but they just want to make money off of it at the end of the day. You got people making giving lobbyists $150,000 so they could impose their views on other people. Why? Whitefish Energy only had two people that were employed full-time when they got the contract for Hurricane Maria on the island. I mean, this is insanity. So the article starts. The fourth floor of the Red Roof Inn felt like a city block on a recent Friday night as families spilled from their rooms into the hallway. Doors were propped open, chihuahuas skittered around on the carpet, and a cluster of teenage boys had claimed a spot by the elevators, a speaker thumping with hip-hop. I'm sorry, I thought that was funny. At the end of the hall, in a room where window framed the dome of the state capitol like a postcard, Jeanette Febres' husband and 12-year-old son watched television on the bed the three of them have been sharing for nearly 3 months. Reaching the end of a day as empty and restless as many of the ones before it. The living conditions were cramped, and the room did not have a microwave or a refrigerator. Miss Febres has asked housekeeping to stop cleaning the room just so she can have something to occupy her time. Even so, she is grateful. Her room, like many of those other families, were staying in, because remember that last video clip said 4,000 families, that FEMA has recorded 4,000 families, living on their aid because they don't have homes back in Puerto Rico, was paid for by FEMA. Amid the turmoil that has unraveled much of her family's life since fleeing Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, the room was one of the few things that seemed stable. For us, she said, this is home. So the article continues. Yet thousands of other families remain in limbo and have been relying on hotel rooms provided by FEMA as they decide whether or not to go back or forge ahead somewhere else. Many people staying in the hotels have described confusion over their cases and anxiety about whether they will be able to stay as deadlines rapidly approach for some as soon as this week. "It has me on pins and needles," said Wanda Arroyo, 56, who has been living in a hotel in Queens. "It has gotten to the point that I don't even pick up the letters slipped under my door because of the expectation that one of them will say I'm being kicked out." Nearly 4,000 families spread across 40 states and Puerto Rico remain in hotels under FEMA's Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program. Federal officials said most families, more than 1,500, were in Florida, while hundreds of others were in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York. More than 800 were in hotels in Puerto Rico. Most of the stays have been extended until March 20th, but about 200 households have been altered that have been alerted that FEMA will stop paying for their rooms as of Wednesday. The agency had already cut off assistance last month for some households after federal officials determined that their homes in Puerto Rico were habitable and had functioning utilities. But let's go back and know the facts that the U.S. government will say something is habitable. They will say that something is okay for people to live in. And then they'll find, oh, there's lead in the water. Oh, there's, you live by a Superfund site. Oh, this, oh, that. That's the thing. If you're black and you're brown, they don't care. They want you to die. They want to kill you. They don't give a crap about you. All you are is a body to them. FEMA said that the agency was hearing appeals from some who had been denied further assistance and added that it was possible for the program to continue after March, and Puerto Rican officials found that it was still needed. But agency officials stressed that the program, which was also used to support families displaced by hurricanes in Texas and Florida, was supposed to be short term. Yeah, and then look how FEMA is not an agency that's going to give people mental health care. FEMA is not an agency that is actually there to help Puerto Ricanos. FEMA is there to distribute money and try to profit off of the money by not giving it to all of the people who need it. They don't care about... The U.S. government does not care about Puerto Ricans. It's an insurance company, right? The tax dollars that we pay into this program is determined by the budget from the government, and the people who are in Congress are mostly white and could care less about Puerto Ricans, and many of them enjoy going to vacation there and want to keep it as a colony because they like to go to pretty white beaches. They like to go to pretty white sand beaches. That's all we are to them, to the white man. So here are these deadlines looming over families of Puerto Ricans trying to survive after a traumatic event without any mental health care, mind you. Being displaced, working probably minimum wage jobs because they don't know English. I mean... This is embarrassing for me, not because they don't know English, but the fact that the U.S. government is doing what it's doing. The U.S. government is going to capitalism. Capitalism is going to capitalism. I really like that. Leroy says that a lot. It's just the truth. Capitalism is going to capitalism. It's going to do what it's going to do. Okay? So, let's get this conversational part of the podcast started now that we've gotten those facts out of the way. The reality is... In sum, that Puerto Ricans are being forced out of their homes, they're coming to the mainland in desperation, and then that desperation continues because they're living in unstable conditions and from hotels with children, applying for Section 8 housing in hopes that they win that lottery to get chosen to live on the mainland. And then on top of that, they're working... They're going to be the new workforce that's going to replace the people who are being deported. It's not difficult. FEMA doesn't care about the Puerto Rican people. They're there to prevent the aid from getting to the people. They only want to profit off of our bodies. Oh, and before I let the conversational part of the podcast start, I do want to elaborate... I want to say, all right, this is how small Puerto Rico is, FYI. I want to elaborate how small the island is. So Leroy's mom was best friends with my cousin's, one of my cousin's close friend's mother. And so they, like, they know the same person and they were friends with the same person, even though Leroy grew up in the diaspora and my cousin Gustavo grew up in Puerto Rico, which is really neat.
Me hace sentir bien saber que el mundo es tan chiquito. Para nosotros que venimos de una isla chiquita y pues, a pesar de que nos han tirado como que en todos sitios y nos han esparcido, es bueno saber que estamos tan conectados. Y
quiero decir que eso como reenfuerza esa idea que somos un pueblo unido, ¿verdad? Que somos de una sangre.
Es eso así. Que de verdad que yo no, porque es como yo le he dicho a Paulita, como que a Paula, que lo que es la idea de la diáspora, para mí es algo, la verdad es que los 24 años que tengo, la mayoría desde los 15 años, pues no tan solo con el LGBT, también antes de la Junta, antes de en el gobierno de Fortuño, en el gobierno de Aníbal Acevedo Vilá, que él tiró a un montón de personas a la calle, amigas de mi mamá, y yo me recuerdo desde una edad pequeña que yo he tenido este sentido de protesta, este sentido de, ¿verdad?, de resistencia hacia la fuerza imperialista que sí permea todo lo que es nuestra isla, además de otros lugares en Latinoamérica. Siempre uno está peleando en la isla y no se da cuenta que la pelea sigue y la resistencia está en otros lugares.
Eso es verdad.
Y ahora con María, obviamente, ahora es que hay una visibilidad para aquellos que estamos en la isla de que no es, Estados Unidos no es el Nirvana que pensamos. No es este cielo escondido de que nada más algunos llegan. Que de verdad que desde acá afuera están tratando de llegar allá a la isla. Y de la isla estamos tratando de llegar acá. Eso es como un ciclo vicioso en el que nos tienen a nosotros migrando de nuestro, o sea, forzando esa migración de nuestro país. Y después, los que se dedican a estudiar lo que de verdad son los Estados Unidos, lo que ellos hacen, lo que nos hacen, son los que al fin y al cabo dicen, aquí no va a ser tampoco.
I know.
Y de verdad, cuando supe que conocía, es como si te conociera de la vida, porque... ¿verdad? No es tampoco...
Yo te digo que la mamá mía y la de él eran amigas íntimas desde los 6, 7 años.
Mira para allá.
La mamá de él era casi tía mía.
Y ahora está, me da una pena porque yo te digo que cuando yo me fui de Puerto Rico, pues yo hablaba con él. Él era la persona, él es mi mejor amigo, él es uno de mis confidants.
Sí.
Y ahora el ir para atrás y no tener a esa persona donde yo siempre iba cuando me sentía mal, es una cosa que hasta el día de hoy son como heridas punzantes. Porque, pues, hay que lidiar con las cosas como pasaron. Y cuando yo estaba acá, pues fue una sorpresa para mí lo que pasó con María. Porque yo vine acá en agosto 19, porque yo sabía que la Junta Fiscal pues iba a implementar unas cosas que si yo, para mí, en mi mente, si yo no venía para acá, yo no iba a progresar en mi país. Y yo iba como que, yo iba a ir, mi mente estaba como que, pues déjame ver las oportunidades, todo lo demás. Pero al venir...
Son mentiras.
Lo que pasa es que yo había ido una vez a Orlando, porque yo fui a Orlando cuando yo tenía 19 años, que fui al DCP, al Disney College Program. Y
¿cuándo fue eso?
En el 2013, a finales, en agosto del 2013.
2013, porque yo conocí a mi esposa, porque estaban trabajando en Disney.
Sí, ¿en qué año?
Ella estaba haciendo el Disney Program.
Yo también. Sí. ¿En qué año lo hizo?
En 2010.
En el 2010.
Un poco antes.
¿Y en dónde trabajó?
Pero Simon, ella lo hizo en Epcot conmigo.
¿En Epcot contigo? ¿Tú trabajabas en Epcot?
Yo trabajaba en Epcot.
Pues la primera experiencia mía de adulto en los Estados Unidos fue en el DCP. Y eso no es experiencia ninguna, porque si tú sabes de lo que hacen en el DCP y más en Vistaway, donde yo me quedé, que yo vivía ahí al ladito de, había un hotel y me recuerdo que estaba Cici's Pizza, que nos daban un descuento, que eran como 3 pesos para ir a comer. ¿Sacho? Y uno ve, tú veías lo que era Orlando, siendo un Puerto Rico, o sea, viviendo allá en Puerto Rico, en Río Piedra, en Coupey, donde mi familia todavía vive. Uno veía lo que era Orlando, yendo a los parques, yendo a los restaurantes, yendo a Downtown Disney. Tú dices, que ¿en qué mundo yo estoy? Que yo nunca he visto esto en mi vida.
I know, allá te lo pintan como lo mejor del mundo, pero esto es, Paula,
¿qué?
The college program what he's talking about, it is a case study in wage theft, a case study in worker exploitation. They pay these guys, because I work there, I'm a local, right, so I was just like a normal worker, whatever. I was still making barely minimum wage working there. They bring these college students from all over the world for a quote-unquote internship, paying them mm-hmm. below minimum wage, putting them in, like, overcrowded, like, housing,
mm-hmm.
and the rent is taken out of their pay. So they're already being paid nothing, and then the rent's taken out of there.
Y una de las cosas más tristes para mí siempre fue que, por lo menos para mí, en experiencia propia, ver un aire central acondicionado, los cuartos que tenían en Florida, como aquí,
uh-huh.
eso para mí era luxury.
Oh, sí.
Era como un hotel. Y yo decía, que ay, qué bueno esto para mí.
Como en la triste. Casa de Tata, que solamente tiene un cuarto con aire. Sí.
Porque tener aire en Puerto Rico, eso es vivir en the lap of luxury.
Un lujo, es sí. un lujo.
No, la casa de mi abuela solamente el cuarto de ella tiene aire.
Sí. Y es un luxury, like, sí. porque mis papás tienen un aire en su cuarto y yo tengo uno en el mío en la casa de ellos y mi hermano tiene uno.
Sí.
Y ellos pagaban 400 y 500 pesos de luz nada más. Cuando yo estaba en Disney, actually, I made like $300 a week. But I was always drunk and going to Paul's and Parliament House.
Parliament House, yeah.
Y Paul's, yo iba mucho a Paul's.
Sí.
Yo iba a Paul's religiosamente todos los días de latino, actually.
Bueno, yo nunca fui, pero fui después de lo que pasó. Mm-hmm. Eso es, te parte el corazón.
Mira.
Al llegar a la acera ahí, solamente al tocar la acera, I break down every single time. Te entra una emoción, una tristeza, un no sé. It's crazy.
Yo diría que el día después, él estaba en un show, yo lo fui a buscar, y él y yo dijimos, mira, pasó lo de Paul, vamos a beber. Nos fuimos a una gasolinera en Río Piedra, afuera de la Yupi. Nos fuimos allá, esa gasolinera estaba 24/7 abierta y tú podías beber y sentarte al frente. Sentábamos y empezamos a llorar todo el día. Porque él también ha ido a Paul's y yo iba a Paul's. Y yo me recuerdo que ese día mi papá me levantó y me dijo, mira, Gustavo, pasó algo en Paul's. Porque o sea, eso fue como a los dos, al año de yo estar en Orlando.
Sí.
Yeah.
Y yo me recuerdo que papi me levantó y yo empecé a llorar porque yo me levanté con un miedo. Porque tú te levantas con un miedo. Es como lo que está pasando ahora con María, con los puertorriqueños que están votando de housing thing.
Mira, quiero hablar de eso. Explicar un poquito sin usar los nombres o...
¿De qué?
De tu amiga.
De los permisos que están pasando. Yo no sé, en Puerto Rico hay una compañía que se llama Shugri. Son unas tripletas. Unas tripletas que ellos venden y están sacando a todo el mundo viejo San Juan. Hay problemas con los permisos. Y San Juan últimamente y Condado y lo que es Santurce, que están todos en la misma línea recta. Todo está siendo gentrified. Y yo me recuerdo después de venir de Disney, tú estabas viendo cómo iba en declive toda la economía de no sé. No, están sacando forzosamente.
Sí.
Y es triste porque yo lo veo todos los días,
mi amistad en Facebook. Eso es un tipo de violencia, y es de verdad.
Yo no sé, yo no me atrevería a usar esas palabras de genocidio. Personalmente también es que yo estoy afectado totalmente.
Porque es difícil.
Y yo no me gustaría ver esto desde un sentido, de una perspectiva muy afuera de eso porque, no sé, yo he estado en protesta y he estado en marchas tantas veces en mi vida y yo lo que recuerdo es sobrevivir por sobrevivir porque no tienes más nada que eso.
Eso es verdad.
Y el verlo de esta perspectiva de que, okay, so están haciendo esto. Llegó el fin del mundo para Puerto Rico. O sea, y, and it's not el fin del mundo, es late term capitalism. Sí, para mí es así la forma que yo puedo describir hasta este momento para poder, o sea, poder situarme en eso.
Yo pienso que es ¿verdad? Como... Like, it's a new beginning para Puerto Rico. Así lo pienso.
Eso mismo yo iba a decir, que es el fin del mundo para Puerto Rico si dejamos que sea así.
Sí. Yo creo que es bien difícil a mantener como un disposición positiva cuando los Estados Unidos, de verdad, they could care less. Quiere que toda la gente de Puerto Rico se vienen a los Estados Unidos to replace the workforce that's being deported. Y eso es la realidad. Eso es la realidad.
Mira, mi amiga, desde que pasó lo de María, mi mejor amiga, la conozco desde los 14, 15 años, que nos conocimos en octavo grado. Salimos del closet juntos y desde ese día no hemos parado de batallar por lo que somos, por lo que seremos y por lo que siempre hemos querido ser, que al fin y al cabo, cuando tú vienes a... Si quieres filosofía, si quieres hablar de política, todo lo demás, es que una persona siempre busca la libertad. Y la libertad viene con tantas facetas y todo lo demás que uno debe de estudiar, reeducarse y reevaluar qué es su identidad para poder lograr eso, ¿no?
Eso es verdad. Porque la libertad no es un, ¿sabes? No es un... There's no end game. La libertad es una lucha constante que nunca para.
Sí.
Porque si tú llegas a un punto que dices, mira, que okay, ahora estoy bien, ahora estoy libre, entonces, ¿qué? ¿Qué pasa? ¿Y no para mí?
Sí, sí. Eso es así. Y ya me dijo, el que sobrevive eso, el ver al ser humano tan... actuando tan... en un modo sobre... hay que sobrevivir y hay que hacer lo que hay que sobrevivir, porque también hay que entender eso. Que el ser humano, al fin y al cabo, somos animales. Y...
eso es verdad.
Y esclavizados estamos.
Como portando como... con los instincts. Como... para afuera, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of like what I try to tell like my family as well, because they're talking about, mira, están robando la gasolina, asaltaron este, blah, 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 qué malos son. I'm like, these are people trying to survive. Uh-huh, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because if you look at a lot of crimes in Puerto Rico, like traditionally, they're all crimes of survival, right? It's stick-ups, it's robberies, it's stuff to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So you can talk about, oh, they're bad and good people, just trying to survive, you know what I mean?
Sí.
Especialmente Puerto Rico, con ese huracán que destroyed everything.
Sí.
No hay nada. So se la van a buscar como puedan, ¿verdad?
Nada. Más allá de la San Sebastián.
And then, ¿es el gentrification bien normal para la gente gringa? Sí. Sí, siempre están sacando, la gente con un poquito de chavito, siempre están sacando la gente que, like, mira, were living there before, and then guess who becomes the workforce, guess who, que siguen viviendo en pobreza, son la gente que viven ahí al lado donde they're gentrifying.
Exacto, mira, déjame decirte algo, yo soy mi familia de Aguadilla, ¿verdad? Y no sé si han ido a Aguadilla. Ahí está la base Reming, que era un U.S. Air Force Base. Y la familia de mi abuelo eran de donde está la base ahora. So, pretty much when they came in, they gave them a deal they couldn't refuse, right? Uh-huh. Mira, coge estos chavos, cómprate un terrenito acá, or we can force you off. You choose. So, ¿qué hacen? Cogen los chavitos y se compra un terreno, right? And then that was open for ages. Y ahora es el aeropuerto de Aguadilla. Pero ahí todavía había un montón de gringos que, pues, son gringos, tienen nombre gringo, pero at least they've sort of assimilated, you know what I mean? They still act Puerto Rican, they still hang out with everything. Pero también Aguadilla,
pero a decir que la gente con un poquito de dinero en Puerto Rico no hacen lo mismo en la comunidad de la gente indígena, taíno, que todavía están... sobreviviendo después de todas las tragedias de España, que todavía, where are my reparations, así es.
Y también, going back to that, en Aguadilla está la área de Playuela, that is this beautiful, virgin, untouched land, like right by the ocean, and you have all these machines, all these bulldozers, everything, trying to knock it down to build a hotel, when all the hotels, when none of the hotels in Aguadilla, to capacity at all. Este
eso. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you no puede tener confianza en el gobierno de los Estados Unidos porque, like, they're not. Y también la gente piensa que el gobierno está trabajando para ellos, but they don't understand it's an extension of corporations. It's just like, oh, this is a legal entity that we can use as an arm. Para violencia, para matar a la gente.
That's exactly right. That's mira, very well put.
Siendo súper, what well I true, siendo bien honesto, yo pienso, ¿verdad? Viendo acá, mi perspectiva ha cambiado un poco porque lo que era mi conocimiento de la de los Democrats and Republicans and all of that shit was very, very, very small. Yo lo que en mi mente siempre he tenido es que los americanos son unos imperialistic scum pigs, whatever that you want to call it. La gente siempre menciona al diablo y no se dan cuenta que el diablo está en todos los televisores que tú puedas ver. El diablo está en todos los periódicos, todas las revistas. El diablo está en todo, en todo ad que tú puedas ver. El diablo existe y el diablo siempre va a ser premiado. Y ese Cornelius Rhodes, eso era el the death angel. The Jew people talk about it. Church, yeah. I mean, it's scary as f- because when you deal with somebody that's going to kill you, and you're just speaking up for it, I mean, you're going to speak up and they're going to kill you for it. It's scary. Y yo entiendo completamente a mis compatriotas, o sea, a las personas que yo conozco que se quieren ir de la isla.
Ahora tenemos grupo como Tiger Swan infiltrating protest camps como en el Standing Rock a sentar aquí a decir que el gobierno de los Estados Unidos de verdad would rather have all native people, all the personas indígenas por todo el mundo, porque la personas olvidan que no solamente son los Taínos, no solamente son los Cherokees, the Shawnee, no solamente son estos tribes que todavía existen. The Aboriginal people in Australia. Yeah,
I lived in Australia for 6 years, and I'm moving back in a few weeks. And if you want to talk about, like, the need to focus on Indigenous people and solidarity with Indigenous people, it needs to start with the Aboriginal people in Australia, because they were systematically bred out of existence. You know how here, like, yeah, they were killed, they were murdered, this and that. And they got reservation because, you know, be natives over here, yeah. There was a systematic effort to breed.
Pero también están haciendo eso aquí también.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pero están haciendo eso también porque la única manera que tú puedas ser native es si el gobierno de los Estados Unidos saca tu sangre y hacen pruebas. So if you don't have a certain amount sangre indígena en los Estados Unidos, then you're not considered.
I'm Apache, but really.
So this this is a video clip from the New York Times. Not my favorite publication, but this is actually a really good piece, and it's titled "A Conversation with Native Americans on Race," and I think it's very essential to have this in our podcast, especially in this robust conversation about what the Boricua identity is and how it relates to the atrocities that are perpetuated by the U.S. government on people of color.
I'm Apache, but really that's the government's name, because they can't say just the guy in there.
They will tell me how awesome they think it is that I've decided to be a part of my culture, and it's funny to me. It hits me really weird, and I don't like it, and I didn't know why at first, but it's because I haven't decided to be a part of my culture. I live it every day.
I'm more comfortable with the term native, divorced from Native American. I know there are people who use indigenous. And if there is one term I do not like to be called, is American Indian.
And for me, to be Indigenous is to have an intimate and interconnected relationship to a homeland.
And so that's really important, because land is, you know, tied to every aspect of who we are.
Being Native in a city is almost a daily reminder of your people's erasure, of the fact that people don't even remember that you're here and that you exist.
But what I did encounter was just this preconceived notion that all Native Americans are dead.
I've had older white men come up to me and say, oh man, if this was 40 years ago, I can just do whatever I wanted to you.
You know, the cattle outside doing the work and the dog inside the house, those are property. Those are the black folks in America. They're our property to white men. Then the exotic antelope on the wall, or the exotic, you know, that's the native.
You're listening to 88.1 FM, KPPPLP, Fargo-Moorhead, adding local color to your airwaves.
That's how natives are perceived in America.
We're treated like animals. They monitor our blood quantum. We're the only, I mean, besides dogs and horses, I don't know of any other animal that they monitor the blood quantum.
The way I explain it to people is like, imagine a pizza with different slices, and let's say 32 slices. Of the 32 slices, I'm 28 Apache. That's my particular blood quantum. And Native Americans in the U.S. are the only minority group who have to prove their nativeness on an Indian card.
It's used to divide Native people against each other, because it can be used as a way to say, I am more Native than you. And I was a part of that, too. I used my 4/4 to kind of make myself feel better against other people.
The one drop rule, meaning that, you know, one drop of black blood makes you black, you know, that was to keep as many people oppressed or, you know, legitimize their oppression as possible. But on the other side, one drop of anything else completely dilutes you as a Native person. So if you're a Native person, you have a one drop of something else, then suddenly you're less Native. So it's the opposite.
Traditionally, within Apache society, you go by the mother. And if the mother's recognized as Apache, she has her clan, the children are unquestionably Apache. Not in the American context, not when patriarchy trumps matriarchy. So what does that mean? My sisters are short 1/16th of a degree. What does that mean? Does it mean their pinkies aren't Apache? What does that mean?
You know, being a mixed race person is a whole another side of it, but that's a very common experience in our tribe. So it's not as if we're unusual in that way. What is unusual is the admixture of black.
My grandfather actually doesn't want people, if he hears that somebody from the tribe is coming over, he won't come out of his room because he doesn't want them to know that he's that complexion. That he doesn't, I guess he doesn't want me to be affiliated with having African-American blood, but I mean, I say it. It's not gonna change anything.
If it were up to the American government, natives wouldn't be around, because after a certain time, that blood will dilute. It will go out. And so if there's no native peoples to provide benefits, then we're not obligated to meet these treaty rights. And if we're not obligated to meet these treaty contracts, then the land is available. The resources are available.
And I think that essential point about our claim to sovereignty, our claim to land, our claim to a culture, our claim to resources, is one that gets lost if we don't insist upon the fact that we are nations.
And we have taken huge steps to decolonizing, and that proof comes from people being able to have the opportunities to speak their language, to be on their ancestral land.
But the thing with decolonization is that it's an ongoing process, just like grieving, just like any loss.
As much as possible now, I try to tell people that I have a Native American name, and maybe it doesn't mean anything to you, but it means everything to me. My name maybe doesn't have a romanticized Hollywood Indian name, but my name has more meaning than that. My name means that my family survived. My family survived disease. My family survived Catholicism. My family survived settler colonialism, colonism, and my family, they survived. I survived. My existence is resistance. Me saying my name is Skiam Tolks, that is resistance in and of itself.
You can claim it all you want, but until the white man says so.
Yeah. Right? See? So the only way you can be a tribe member is si el gobierno de los Estados Unidos saca tu sangre, whether you like it or not, para hacer un prueba. To say, oh, you're more Native than other people. So, you know, that causes infighting in Native. Now, I'm not saying that all Native people are like this, right? This isn't an overgeneralization. But when you look into the materials and you do the research, it causa infighting también. Porque es quien tiene la sangre más pura.
Exactly.
And then it's a fight for resources también. Porque yes, you,
exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but the whole thing in Hawaii with the land rights and Alaska as well.
Yeah, because it's the illusion of scarcity para mantener capitalism. Exacto.
Yeah, exactly.
So I always think, like, in China, in India, por todos los lados, in Africa también, those tribes are dying, not just because of globalization.
Exactly. See, like, I'm a Marxist, I'm a socialist, so I see everything through the eyes of, like, class consciousness, right?
Uh-huh.
And for me, capital precedes racism, right? Because I don't think that anyone is necessarily born racist, or white people are naturally born on a white supremacist. It's always been that preservation of the power of capital. And it just so happens in the Western world that white people have been the owners and facilitators of capital, right? So everything has been to preserve that. And it's that preservation of asymmetrical power. So the way they do that is to put us down, to, you know, keep us uppity Hispanics, uppity Negroes down, right? And even with, like, the poor white people, like, making us the scapegoats, right? Because you're poor, you're white and poor because of these people over here, not because of the power that they have. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing everywhere else.
Pero también, es que también, okay, so aquí en Kentucky específicamente había personas blancas que eran tan pobres como los Haitians en Haiti que estaban comiendo clay.
Yeah, the mud cakes, yeah.
Yeah, aquí en los Estados Unidos, en Kentucky.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly
but
right.
But they would say stuff like, I would rather be this poor than be black. And no dijeron negro. You know what they said en vez de eso. So to sit here and say that, okay, and a veces como, you can be poor and white and not be a racist. That eso es la realidad.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
Then a lot of white people are racist because they say a lot of microaggressive stuff. And como a veces como me frustro. Porque yo sé que yo soy... Like, I don't know if I'm white passing. Yo sé si soy blanca. I really don't know how to describe myself porque depende. I don't really know. De verdad, porque mucha de mi historia de mi familia es bien trágica. So,
sí, yo creo que para nosotros, en fin, nuestra familia nunca ha sido definitivamente un color. Y yo soy una persona que a mí no me gusta usar estos términos de colorismo, colorism, identity politics,
sí.
Son para mí algo nuevo. No es algo que yo he estado anejado. O sea, yo no, I haven't been privy, I mean, privy. I have been, what is privy?
Like, privy, lo mismo que anejado. Aware.
Aware.
Yeah. I have been aware of it, pero no al extent que está pasando ahora, como lo leo en Afropunk o lo leo en muchos sitios.
Yeah.
A veces me siento como Tarzán saliendo de una jungla, aunque yo no sé si...
Ay, qué...
Sí, no, pero es que la educación en Puerto Rico es trágica. Eso es algo sí que yo tengo que decir, que para mí lo que es estar en Estados Unidos, lo que está en Estados Unidos sí te deja un conocimiento mucho más grande de lo que tenemos en Puerto Rico. Porque muchas de las cosas que yo sé las he tenido que leer yo, y eso es una eventualidad que me hace diferente a todos mis compañeros y todos mis vecinos y todos mis familiares. Porque no es fácil el tú ser educado y sobrevivir al mismo tiempo en la isla. Hay personas que sí lo logran, pero es un 1 entre 10. Y in fighting the odds when you're poor, it doesn't turn favor every time.
Yeah.
Y para mí todo lo que se tiene que ver con los nativos y a Boric, que es todo, actually, y los de Australia, los de aquí, los de India, los de Asia, yo siempre sé de ellos por the LGBT stories that come out in social platforms.
Exacto. Yes.
Y cuando yo he visto los de Australia, cómo ellos viven, and that's squalor, actually.
Por todos los lados viven así.
Así. Y mira, los nativos americanos de Estados Unidos.
Una cosa también. Verlo en social media, otra cosa verlo
ahí. Es presencial.
The way they've been treated, the way they're still being treated. And this isn't a country that's a social democracy, right? They have universal health care. They have amazing public transportation, free college. But capitalism is still going to capitalism. Like, white supremacy is still going to be white supremacy. You know what I mean?
Y a decir que los europeos, they're so advanced, is the most mentira, mentira, mentira. You talk about people that literally do blackface around Christmas time to celebrate
The Schwarze Piet or whatever?
The Netherlands,
yeah.
Creo.
Yeah, the Schwarze Piet.
See.
And that's another thing. When people talk about how advanced Europe is and, like, Scandinavia, they should be the model. No one asks, like, why are they that advanced? Like, it didn't just happen. They extracted their wealth from somewhere else. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because
Africa.
They don't have a history of, like, natural resources. You know what I mean? They had to go around conquering the world to extract their wealth and labor resources and take that capital back to Europe, leaving every other country, every other place on the planet underdeveloped. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
La gente siempre, hablan de la ciudad del Dorado, que está en América Latina.
Sí.
Uh-huh. Y eso fue algo que trajo muchos europeos que estaban settling en Puerto Rico. La ciudad del Dorado y esa fábula los llevaron a todos los que estaban en Puerto Rico asentados a ellos vivir allá en el continente sudamericano. Yeah. Mucha gente habla de eso que está en Perú, entre Perú y la Amazonas, o las Amazonas que están en Perú, la parte de las Amazonas que está en Perú. Pero Puerto Rico tiene muchas cosas, tiene muchos resources. Ellos lo saben, los americanos saben que Puerto Rico tiene todavía muchos resources that they can extract for profit.
Oh, tú sabes, el trabajo de FEMA es to prevent the aid from getting to puertorriqueños. Eso por fin is why they're there. They're there to guard the resources. They're not going to give that stuff. And then todo the hassle que los puertorriqueños necesitan. They need to drive to the people, and then they have to sign the paperwork, and then necesitan una estatua de non-profit para sacar la cosa de FEMA.
Exactly. FEMA's are like insurance companies. Like, it's in the best interest not to give out aid.
FEMA is an insurance company. That's capitalism.
So, mamá, ¿por qué hay personas dando donaciones a FEMA cuando FEMA no está giving out the stuff, repartiendo las cosas la manera que it should be? They should be going door to door. The Red Cross didn't even do its job right when it was there. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers no está ahí para ayudar a la gente de Puerto Rico. They're there scouting the resources para robar las cosas. That's what the U.S. government does. The U.S. government goes to Afghanistan. And that guy wouldn't survive a summer in Puerto Rico with his white para quemar el sol. Qué bueno. Que se quema.
Oye, cuando esto es una bestia, como decía Cáncer Miranda, esto es una bestia. Ahora que las personas sepan que es una bestia y cuán grande es la bestia y cuán asquerosa es la bestia, son otras cosas. Pero para mí que ellos te van a matar, ellos te van a matar para quitarte lo que tú tienes, para desvertir.
Sí, pero ojalá se enferma con dengue.
Ellos van a vivir de nosotros, hasta de nuestra sangre.
But that's the thing though as well, they're gonna do that, but then they're gonna tell us it's good for us, like that they're doing us a favor, you know what I mean?
Like, just to see toda la gente viniendo a Estados Unidos, y like in my mind I scream, ay, ¿por qué?
Yo de verdad que soy como un pseudo anarquista.
Yo también.
No soy anarquista, porque es como llega un punto que yo creo que no es nuestra realidad el pretender que esto está bien. Porque no lo está. Y
a vivir aquí con miedo. Y
literalmente que te estén matando.
Sí.
Que hayas matado lo que es, lo que yo conocía como era mi isla, por todo lo que yo he vivido. Esto no está bien. Y que lo hagan hecho en toda conciencia, en toda... They did it because that's what they do. And llega un punto que es mejor... I mean, I'm an anarchist. I'll call me anarchist, actually. But...
Sí.
Anarchism for the win.
Uh-huh.
Es lo que yo...
I think we're all red black flags
here. En mayo 1, yo me puse una venda en la boca y nadie me podía reconocer. Y nos tiramos a la calle y peleamos. Y eso es lo que hace el puertorriqueño al fin y al cabo. Se resiste a todo imperialismo. Se resiste...
Mira, que la policía en Puerto Rico está protestando.
Ay, sí, sí, ahora les dio con protestar. Después que nos escupían en la cara y se reían también.
Diciéndote mal agradecido, esto, lo otro. Ahora son ellos que están en las calles.
Eso es así. Mejores momentos de mi vida fue cuando me paré policía, la cara de un policía en la cara a mí. Y yo le decía puerco, le decía de todo lo que ellos me decían a mí también. Y por eso es que te digo que soy una... O sea, no es que... Yo no voy a teorizar ni voy a, ¿verdad?, a implementar lo que para mí es el anarquismo, porque puedo estar totalmente en the wrong, right? But not really, porque para mí...
No, yo siento que la gente pobre, como ya decimos, uno al otro, ya vivimos en el anarquismo. That's what mi primo siempre me dice eso, Paula, ya Puerto Rico, todo el mundo tan pobre, sobreviviendo a la manera que necesitan sobrevivir.
Como me decía mi mejor amiga, cuando tú no ves bondad, cuando tú no ves comida, y tú tienes que pelear por tu comida, that's a problem. Pero no es turn against each other, turn against...
Sí.
Who's making us turn against each other?
That's exactly, that is well put.
Y también el gobierno de Puerto Rico es el gobierno de los Estados Unidos, porque ya sabemos uno al otro que la Junta Fiscal tiene control completamente de qué está pasando en la isla. And all of those billionaires, los siete, podían they could give the island el dinero que necesita. Pero they're so greedy and they're white supremacists. And no importa de verdad si vivimos o si murieron, like if we die. The only thing they care about is el dinero que tienen en su cuenta.
Ellos nos dicen que somos culturales. El decirnos que somos culturales is what they said to Native Americans. They have culture. They entonces ellos profit out of that. They co-opt culture. They literally gentrify your soul, to be honest. Does that make sense?
Oh, but, mira, way, recuerda del spirit side. Eso
yeah,
es la cosa. Side. Sí, que es spirit side, que están matando tu espíritu.
Spirit side, that's a good term.
Y ellos, sí, en la casa del gobernador ahí en San Juan, sí, habían party, que regalados ellos hacían, cuando estaba en un décimo grado, o duodécimo, 12th or 11th grade. Regalados ellos hacía party en the governor's mansion and everybody would get drunk. Y uno de mis primos, el hijo de tío Manuel y tía Nereida, el mayor, estuvo en Marista, en donde él estudió. No sé si fue Marista, era Marista o otro colegio en Guaynabo, que era católico. Porque en Puerto Rico el clasismo es una cosa que se va de la desborda.
Oh my God, que ocho no tan bien, porque like everybody has a family member that's poor AF because they've wasted all their money or algo así, o nacieron en la pobreza, and then you always have somebody that married into money porque that's what you're trained to do.
Lo que pasa es que nosotros venimos de tres hermanas que venían de clase alta en Río Piedra. Nuestra abuela era, yo creo que era la presidenta o fue un coacher.
No, abuela was like...
Y ella era del club Rotario de San Juan y Río Piedra, que eran los clubes esos como los que tienen acá.
Exclusivos. Yeah.
That they would help people and whatnot. Pero nuestra abuela, que es Milta Gorujo, ella pues fue asesinada por el esposo y el esposo se suicidó al frente de nuestras mamás. Oh, y wow. Ahí es que viene el trauma que nos llevó un poquito más avanzadamente a llegar a estos ideales que tenemos hoy en día. Porque cuando tú tienes estos traumas, you really have to introspect, is that how you say?
Sí.
Yeah. And when you have really bad traumas over whatever issue, you really have to look into yourself. And within that, you actually find your identity if you're small, if you are woke enough.
Sí.
But I don't like that word either because it doesn't really attach itself to anything in Spanish. I don't like to use words that they don't have like a translation.
Sí.
What is woke in, I mean, despertar, estoy despierto, but yeah.
Está despierto, pero no suena...
Pero
like...
eso es lo que tú le dices a tu mamá si te está despertando cuando está en octavo grado. Que te dicen, ¿estás despierto? Sí, estoy despierto. Pero it doesn't really translate that well, woke.
Pero también en mi familia, mi abuelo, he was one of the first Green Berets in the Vietnam War. Y of course, que era un... Mi abuelo era moreno. And he was, él tenía, porque yo soy tan blanquita, ¿verdad? Pero mi abuelo era bien como mestizo. Y and when he went to the Vietnam War, of course they sent him to the very front lines. Y mi abuelo mandó un montón de cartas a mi abuela. Pero mi abuela solamente abrió 3 de las esas cartas porque las cosas que mi abuelo estaba describiendo en esas letras, esas cartas, eran tan fuertes. Que mi abuela se quemó todas las cartas.
Wow.
Y, like, so, I mean, hello. And era un alcohólico y abusó a mi padre. So, what do you think is going to be like cuando una mujer que sus padres se murieron la manera como murieron y mi papá era un hijo de un hombre que estaba en el ejército boricua en el 1970... Para get his GI Bill, pero I don't know if he was drafted, pero he always told people he got his GI Bill. Y era doctor. He got his, like, era un dentist, y mi papá también. Pero, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? These people are not going to be normal. They're going to be loco. Son, especialmente because they didn't get mental health care. I mean, imagínate como el machismo y todo eso.
Que generational too, right?
Exacto, it's generational. Que mi abuela Chati era de los campos. She always told people that she didn't have shoes y todo eso. I mean, these people lived in poverty. And then mi bisabuelo, se murieron bien joven. Y mi abuela, su mamá se murió cuando ella tenía como 5 años. Y mi abuelo era canito, pero era bien, pero porque yo creo que era de Europa. Esto es mi bisabuelo. And esto es al lado de mi papá. Pero he said like really racist stuff and my grandma would tell me it. And then mi abuela es bien racista. And it made, you know, say como like, yo siempre como, I look at her like she's crazy. Como es bien loca.
Para mí siempre ha sido, mi papá es afrocaribeño.
Sí.
Mi papi tiene, la mamá de mi papá es nativo americana de Maryland. I don't remember the tribe. I think it was the Sioux tribe. Like you say that.
Oh, sí.
Pero papi es negrito. Mi mamá es blanca. Mi mamá no es blanca. She's white person. I don't know what's the term for
it. I don't know tampoco. Because I really, como, like, you have some, con toda tu familia.
Light, but not white.
Yeah.
Exacto.
Así siento.
Pero, entonces yo soy más light skin. Y yo te digo en toda confianza, desde que yo tengo edad y uso razón, yo me sentía blanquito. De verdad, yo me sentía que yo era, porque yo era canito, yo era cano. Pero no cano, yo era, mi piel tiene, yo tengo un tono súper, ¿cómo yo lo describiría? Porque ahora parece que tengo que estar...
A veces como yo tengo miedo, porque de verdad yo no sé cómo describir cómo soy. Y
I know.
Y siempre como me atacan. Porque, mira, porque yo no soy, primero, yo sé que yo no estoy estúpida, yo no soy negra, I know that, ¿verdad? Mira, y yo sé que eso es algo, ¿qué?
No, yo soy bastante tereño, like, 10, ¿verdad? 10. La mamá y mía, yeah, la easy. Familia de parte de mi abuela, de mi mamá, son todos blancos, que parecen... Cuando mi abuela y mi abuelo fueron a Nueva York, todo el mundo allá pensaba que mi abuela era italiana, so they're really like European looking. Pero de parte de mi abuelo, su esposo de esa abuela, son blancos también, pero con las narices anchas, con el pelo rizo, casi malo, como decimos nosotros, que es otra frase.
Ay, me pongo tan triste cuando las personas dicen cosas así, porque, I mean, like, mi pelo es bien straight. Mira, y no puedo, I cannot mantener un rizo para como 2 segundos y ya se cae.
No, and on my other side, like, my father, you look at him walking on the street, parece un afroamericano, como cualquiera. You know, tú sabes que es hispano porque parece hispano, but he's, you know, dark skin.
Ajá.
Pero el papá de él era blanco, de Ponce, y la mamá era negra.
Sí.
So it's like, how do we describe ourselves? Like, I have both, like, Afro features, but also, like, European features. I have really curly, like, nappy hair. And my hair is dreading right now naturally because it's like that. And when you talk, like, I guess the pressure that we feel to have to try to, like, identify what we are, who we are, you know what I mean? That's another sort of example of, like, this need, capitalistic need, this white supremacist need to sort of, like, label what we are. And we internalize that, which is absurd, you know what I mean? Porque, you know, at the end of the day, somos boricua, ¿verdad?
Sí. Sí, pero siempre, like, como el argumento que yo siempre oigo, es que, oh, pero to be Puerto Rican is a nationality, right? And then Latinx is your ethnicity. And then your race is el color de tu piel. Pero hay tantas diferentes...
What does that mean? What does that mean?
I know.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Pero, I feel... Es como un sentimiento bien overwhelming también. Porque la gente, pero la gente blanca, they just treat me like, cuando yo digo que yo soy Latinx, it's over, game over. Ya me tratan como yo soy, ¿verdad? Like, they just treat me like I'm nothing.
You see, I'm already brown, so I get that up front, so.
I mean, it really depends, though, because I'm cafre de so, like, como la manera que yo hablo, siempre hay gente que dicen algo como, oh, where you grow up in the hood, blah, blah, blah. Pero así yo hablo bien directa. And so I'll just be like, no, I'm Puerto Rican. Like, this is the way I talk, whatever. Como yo aprendí inglés cuando yo tenía 6 años. So yo tengo como un acento raro, I guess. Y también, I grew up in el south, en el sur de América. So I've got like a touch of un poquito de todo, siento.
Para mí, mi hermano es más oscurito que yo. No es que oscurito, es que mi papá es negro y mi mamá es blanca. So, we're both mulatos. Mami siempre me decía que éramos mulatos. That we have to say we're mulatos. Porque cuando yo me recuerdo creciendo en la escuela, si, como eran escuelas católicas y los católicos tienen un sentido de white supremacy as because a lot of Catholics, a lot of the popes have been from Poland and all of that shit.
La religión es un tool.
Sí, un tool.
De colonialism. Porque, what is the way that they indoctrinated Native American children?
Uh-huh. That's how they justified it, though.
La religión. Uh-huh.
Y yo me recuerdo que a mí, my mom, we have to define ourselves. And my mom will tell us, oh, you're mulatto's children. And for me, that was something else because I always wanted to be like that lead singer of ABBA or Stevie Nicks. I wanted to be that white blonde woman in the TV. But that has to do with my whole LGBT. Sometimes I forget I'm actually an Afro-Caribbean gay person. That's a lot. That's a lot in my plate for a minute. I guess when you're doing that much for so much, you don't really see outside of it. And when people tell you that Puerto Rico is not a thing, because people will tell you that here.
Oh, my God. Oh, the United States, like, they gave you your citizenship. You guys are Americans. Americans, hard.
It's like, we didn't ask for that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. No, you only gave it to us because of World War I. That's why.
Exactly. Like, they need a cannon fodder. They were running out of people. Era, vamos a mandar esto trigueño, whatever. It's after that, the imposition of the Jones Act and all that to
pay off part of like the war debt.
But we're still
feeling like
that would be going up to like Afghanistan and being like, "Hey, homies, you owe us." No, that's embarrassing. That's like going to Vietnam and saying, "Oh, you owe us because we invaded you." Y tú sabes que los españoles, they didn't even fight. They lost Cuba already. They lost the Philippines already. They were like, oh, okay, well, you know, here you go, Teddy Roosevelt, who led the hit on San Juan Hill.
Exactly, because at that point as well, like, that whole bombing of the Maine, that was propaganda by, like, the newspapers, by William Randolph Hearst. They're the ones that started the war.
And the New York Times is, like, the number one perpetrator. Uh-huh. But, like, the New York Times is the number one propaganda machine lover since before this time.
Yeah.
So, me gusta, me encanta. Like, I will retweet some New York Times article, depending en el tema y quien está escribiendo ese artículo. Pero to sit here and say que está bien, que están haciendo entrevistas y dando un plataforma para los, for the white supremacists. Qué locura, qué bochorno.
I know.
And to sit here and say que no hay propaganda en los Estados Unidos es una cosa bien ignorante.
But that's American exceptionalism, right? Like, we're not the bad guy. Propaganda is bad. We're the good guy. We don't do that. Everyone
pero también es que usan la democracia. La mentira de la democracia.
Democracy, yeah.
But,
because, like, what the hell are, like, fighter jets doing at the Super Bowl? You know what I mean? Tell them, you're gonna tell me that's not propaganda? Like,
uh-huh. Para los hombres también que son machistas aquí en los Estados Unidos. Because really, I don't know a lot of people who watch the NFL who aren't like pro-patriotism y todo eso.
That's why they lost to Colin Kaepernick started kneeling.
Uh-huh.
Because the NFL, the U.S. government, did a very, very amazing job at conflating football and like Americanness. You know what I mean?
Porque so antes era baseball. Porque recuerda, antes era baseball, but let me tell you, you know how many Puerto Ricans were really good at baseball? Let me just, you know, throw that out there.
Exactly. Speaking of which, the Caribbean Series is on at the moment.
Dito Clemente vivía ahí en Rodrigo Piedra, en la avenida 65.
Ay, qué tragedia, cómo se murió, Dios mío. Siempre hay una tragedia en nuestra vida. Eso es porque tenemos tantos chismes.
He died in solidarity. He died taking aid to, like the brothers in Nicaragua.
Sí, es verdad, y no, like, no estoy diciendo que
he was a humanitarian his entire
pero
life,
Dios mío, se murió un choque de un avión. That's still not a good way to go. I mean,
so absolutely not.
Es una tragedia. I mean, yeah. He was bringing aid, ¿verdad? Estaba haciendo algo bueno, pero he still died. And I always feel like it's always Puerto Ricans. Always. We always die in war. Like, we die back home. And you're like, it's colonialism, ¿verdad? Because, alcoholism, drug problems están en nuestras comunidades. Mm-hmm. And then, yo siempre digo, especialmente a mi amigos blancos que son leftists. Y I like to use the term leftist porque yo sé que había un debate earlier. Porque es so, it draws liberals in. Yeah. It's como un Venus flytrap de una palabra.
It's the open window, in fact.
Ajá. It draws people in who think that they're to the left, and then como they have that moment of, ooh, no, yo soy una comunista.
Exactly. It's like, well, I like Bernie, I'm a leftist, until they talk to us like commies, and they're like, wait a minute, no, I'm not.
You mean we can't appropriate people's culture anymore?
Yeah, no.
You won't let me wear a Native American headdress. How is that wrong? I thought I could wear moccasins. I'm 180,000% Cherokee.
Yeah. You get those people who's like, well, I'm a 10th Cherokee, so, and I'm not offended, so it's okay. I'm like, shut up.
Y también, especialmente, like, they have no idea. It's like, have you done esa prueba? Have you done the prueba yet to find out how Cherokee you are? See which tribe you belong to? All right, this is it for episode 6. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. I hope that you enjoyed our conversation and that it enlightened you on what it was like to be Boricua in the diaspora. And I hope that you check out our tenets and that document in the show notes. And thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate if you could share. I would really appreciate if you could share the podcast on your social media and get it out there so more people can listen to it and become more educated on what's happening in Puerto Rico and about capitalism and how it's just the end stage and we're just all watching it go to crap. We're all watching it go to crap. I hope you guys have a good week. I promise I'm still catching up on the rest of the stuff I have to edit because this podcast is only just snippets of material. Anyway. Deuces, bye.
You're listening to 88.1 FM, KPPP LP, Fargo-Moorhead, adding local color to your airwaves.